or most importantly, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. And with that, Jerry is going to come up and introduce our speaker.
Hey, everybody, I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jerry. Hey, Jerry.
If you're like me, even if you didn't drink like me, you probably knew somebody that was at the party later than, and you're like, wow, give it up. But they kept going and going and going, trying to get the last little bit out of the party. And that's how I drank. And then sometimes we end up in here, and those same people that we see trying to get the last little bit out of the party, trying to jumpstart that thing they can't get jumpstarted, don't do so well. They don't go for it. And that's not at all like your speaker tonight. We asked Jackie to speak for a reason, because I wasn't around when she drank, but I was fortunate enough to get to know her a bit and spend some time with her. And I know that, like my drinking, she is not satisfied with status quo. She's not satisfied with staying still or stagnant. She wants to go to that next peak, that next peak. She's going to push herself. She's going to push her recovery. So with that, I know we're in for a real treat. We're real excited. I'll give you Jackie.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jackie.
I'm nervous. I'm going to try and relax then. I just want to say that I'm really excited to be talking at this meeting tonight, because this meeting in particular has really been an important meeting throughout my recovery. When I first came into the rooms, this is one of the first meetings I came to. And I loved it. You know, I felt at home right away here. And I kept coming. You know, I've been coming to this room for the past 18 months. And I just really enjoy the fellowship in this room, and I enjoy the young people. I think it's really hopeful to see a lot of young faces out there. And I like the message that's delivered from this podium. So I've got a lot to live up to tonight, which makes me nervous. But I'm just going to get started. I am an alcoholic, and what that means is that I suffer from an obsession of the mind along with an allergy of the body. For me, if I start to drink, I can't stop. I never just have one. Never. Like, never in my whole drinking career did I just have one or two drinks. It was always full force all the way. And that's the way I drank. And I'm just going to read one little passage that kind of speaks to my story a lot. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And for me, I could never enjoy my drinking when I was trying to control it. And when I was trying to control it, I wasn't enjoying it. Or did I say that backwards? I don't know. Y'all know what I mean. I'm really nervous. All right. The reason why, you know, that really speaks to my story in particular is because you'll see as I go through my story that as I started out in my younger years, it was really like full on. You know, I drank heavily through my teen years and up through my 20s. And then as I got older and became a responsible adult, I found this need to control my drinking, and I had to function as a wife and a mother, and I couldn't drink as much as I wanted to. So that's why I wanted to read that in particular. For me, more importantly, I think it's important to recognize what's true of all of us as alcoholics. And that's that we all suffer from a spiritual malady. And that was so true for me. From the earliest memories that I have, you know, I always was just restless, irritable, and discontent. I never fit in. I never felt comfortable around other people. I was scared to be around other people, and I was scared what other people thought of me. And I just felt less than everybody. I felt like I just didn't fit in. Most of all, it was like, it was the thing about what other people thought about me. You know, it was, I felt like I went through life always caring what everybody thought, and it made me uncomfortable. You know, I never was able to just state my opinions, talk openly in front of other people, like I'm having trouble doing right now. I can't let people see the real me because I'm too scared of what everybody's going to think. So, you know, through this program, I've been able to overcome that. And for that, I'm very thankful, you know. I felt that way all through my childhood until I found a solution. And the solution for me came at age 14, and that solution was found in alcohol. When I took that first drink, that all melted away, and I felt a part of for the first time in my life. I was hanging out with some friends from high school. It's kind of funny actually, like my parents were moving, we were moving into a new house. And so we decided to sneak out and go to this new house the night before the moving van came. So me and my friends like showed up at the house in the middle of the night and got a bunch of beer and was like, this is my first time I'd ever had a drink. And you know, we had like a 12 pack of beer and you know, I just kept drinking it and I remember it was gone and thinking, you know, I can't believe it's gone. I want more. And, you know, I felt comfortable, you know. I felt like I could hang out with everybody. I felt like, you know, people cared what I had to say. I felt I felt at ease for the first time in my life. And I wanted to pursue that feeling. So I continued to chase that feeling for the next 25 years. And I came into the rooms really late, you know, like I was out there for a long time, and it was really to be able to find that when I needed that so much when I was 14 years old. And for the first time, I felt okay. So that went on through high school, through college. But the thing that was that it never, I was never really held accountable for my drinking. Like my parents never really punished me. They were big drinkers themselves. And you know, it wasn't like if I got caught drinking, it was kind of like it was okay or something. And so I never really had any consequences like from my parents. I luckily never got in trouble with the law the whole time I was out there, which is miraculous. Several times I was pulled over for a DUI, actually one time by a DUI task force officer. And I learned pretty quickly that you never tell them, you know, oh yeah, I just had a couple. You know, I would never say, oh yeah, I just had a couple. It's like, no, I've had nothing. I had no drinks at all. Because that was, you know, you don't want them to think that, you know, you've had anything to drink or else they're going to give you a breathalyzer, right? So I was, we were coming back from a bar in Buckhead, and I had my sister in the car. And they pulled me over, asked me if I'd had anything to drink, and I said, you know, no, I've been home all night. I'm actually sick, and I just went and picked my sister up at the bar. And, you know, this was a DUI task force officer. I also had a big bag of outside issues under the seat of my car. You know, that was a big part of my story as well. But I got away, you know, like they didn't, and that happened twice. Like another time I got pulled over and didn't get a DUI when I certainly should have. And then another time, I wrecked my car. I was coming home from a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning and was very upset because of some guy that had been at the bar and it was driving recklessly and very, very drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was almost home. I was on almost to my parents' street and I started sneezing uncontrollably. So this was a big reason why I could always excuse this away, you know, because I started sneezing uncontrollably, slammed my car into a brick mailbox and went over a slight embankment. And so I always told myself, well, you know, it wasn't because I was drunk, it was because I started sneezing, you know. And so I knew that I had to get away from that wreck. So I got out of the car and started trekking it to my friend's house about a mile away. And he drove me home to my parents' house, woke my parents up because I knew I was going to have to tell them about the car. So I woke them up. My dad was mad, but ended up totally enabling me by going back to the scene of the wreck without me and talking to the cops who wanted to come back to the house and arrest me because they knew I was drunk. And my dad was like, no, you can't. You know, so it was always like that for me. It was always, you know, my dad or my parents or whoever would, you know, I'd get out of these scrapes, like somehow, I don't know, I guess God just wasn't ready for me to have those consequences. But I never had any consequences and therefore stayed out there for a really long time because, you know, I almost wish at this point that I had had some kind of consequence that wouldn't have kept me out there until the age of 39. But, you know, that's my story and, you know, that's what happened and I, you know, I just have to trust that it happened that way for a reason. So, you know, I partied hard like that up until, you know, through my 20s. And then I got married when I was in my mid-20s. And when I got married, it was to a guy who's not one of us, who is like the good guy, you know, that my parents always hoped that I would marry somebody like this, you know. And so I had to change my behavior. I couldn't party the way that I wanted to party. And, you know, we started having kids a couple years later, and that just added to it. And so basically, by the time I got married and started having children, I was unable to party the way I wanted to, and I had to control the way that I drank, which is very unusual. Like, you don't really hear many people say that, you know, by the time the end came that they were drinking in a controlled way. But I really kind of was, because I had to put all these things in place that would keep me from going out of control and not being able to function in my household and in my job. So I would, you know, put these things like, you know, no drinking until 6 o'clock. And I would stop drinking at like midnight. And when I did that, the spiritual malady was rampant within me. I should have been drinking a lot more than I was. Like it was, the people around me would have been a lot happier. Let's just put it that way. If I had been drinking all day long, I would have been a lot more fun to be around. Because this controlled drinking that I was trying to do, it just wasn't enough. Like, I couldn't function in life because I needed my solution, and I didn't have it to the full extent that I needed it. So this spiritual malady, you know, my problem was really, it was the thinking, you know, it was like my head was the problem. My alcoholic mind, you know, that was the ultimate destruction of me. And the final thing that happened was I would exhibit these episodes of rage. Like, I would just get completely out of control and go crazy on my family, like on my husband, on my kids. I would, you know, yell and scream and throw things at them, and it was really, really bad. And, you know, they couldn't, it went on that way for several years. And finally, one morning, this happened. You know, we got into an argument over something totally stupid in the morning. Like, I was hungover. It was 6 o'clock, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, trying to get the kids off to school. And we got into an argument, and, you know, it was the typical, you know, yelling, screaming, throwing things type behavior from me, because I felt terrible because I was hungover. And so my husband just decided that he'd had enough. You know, he put his foot down for the first time on that, and he left. He took my kids and left and went to his parents' house and said that if I didn't go get help, that he would, that would be it. You know, we would get divorced, he would have the kids. You know, I knew I would never see my kids again. So I was basically given an ultimatum at this point. And I really believe that that morning, I mean, because my husband tells me that it's like he was going to just take the kids to school like normal. And something told him just to keep driving past the school. And, you know, I really believe that that was the grace of God. You know, it was one of those little windows that we get that we sometimes ignore. But thankfully that day he, you know, he followed what God had planned. And he told me that I had to go to rehab or else he wasn't coming back. And this was terrifying for me because I was all alone at my house by myself. I was gripped with fear because I was alone, which is one of the biggest fears that I found in my inventory, was a fear of being alone, a fear of abandonment, and that's what happened. It came true, and it was just terrifying. So I agreed to go, and the thing was is that at that time, I still wasn't convinced that it was the drinking that was the problem. I really just thought I was crazy, and I was crazy, but I mean, definitely, but I didn't really connect the dots, you know. It's like, I've got the drinking under control. I mean, can't you see, you know, I don't drink all day. I stop drinking, you know, at a reasonable hour at night, and, you know, what's the problem? It's not the drinking. So, you know, that was hard for me to admit, but I agreed to go anyway, and I went. And when I arrived at rehab, I was very scared. I was scared to be there because I knew that I was going to have to look at myself, you know? I was going to have to really see what was up with me and figure out what's going on inside my crazy head. So once I arrived, the first thing I did, of course, is go out to the smoking section, and where I spent a whole lot of time while I was there. As most of you know, I think I smoked about 3 packs a day while I was in rehab. But anyway, so I go out to the smoking section at rehab, and everybody's standing around, you know, talking about what people talk about in the smoking section at rehab, which is, you know, war stories of being out there. And I kept thinking to myself, God, you know, these people are way more fucked up than me. You know? Like, I am not nearly as bad as these people. What am I doing here? These people are totally different than me. And it was upsetting, you know. I was like, I don't belong here, you know. What is up with this? You know, why did they stick me in this place? All this self-pity, you know, just coming out. So I went inside, and I found this really nice tech, and who's in recovery, and I still see him sometimes. He's a great guy. But I told him, you know, I was like, what's up? You know, like, I'm not supposed to be here. You know, I don't know who these people are, but this is not me. And I'm, this is, you know, I don't, there's a problem here because I'm different from these people. And he said, you know what? He's like, I urge you to look at the similarities rather than the differences. And then it was like a light bulb went off in my head because I thought to myself, you know, wow, okay, that makes sense, you know, because some of the stuff they're saying, you know, I do kind of feel that way. So from that point on, I really had an open mind. And that was so critical because to be able to look at the similarities rather than the differences is such an important thing. You know, I started to identify with these people who were just like me. They may have done different drugs or, you know, had worse consequences than I did, but the bottom line was that we all suffered from the same disease and all of our thinking was the same. So for the first time in my life, I actually realized that it wasn't that I was just crazy. You know, I had always thought that I was, you know, crazy and morally defective. And in actuality, I'm an alcoholic. So, you know, that's great. Because now it's like I was kind of glad in a way. It's like, okay, I figured this out. There's people like me. You know, I'm not the only person. I'm not the only one out there whose brain works the way that my brain works. There's other people out there who feel that way too. So that was really cool. And it allowed me to just have, you know, once I had this realization, it allowed me to have a really good experience while I was at rehab. I, you know, I had an open mind. I learned a lot about my disease. I had that time away, you know, like I really feel like I couldn't have done it like if I'd stayed home in the midst of my family. And you know, I had to take that time away where I could, you know, get to know myself and get to, you know, start getting into the work, which we really kind of did. I mean, they gave me a big book when I got to rehab, and I had never seen a big book before. I didn't know what a big book was. And I opened it up and I started reading some stuff, and it was hard to get through. You know, there was a lot, you know, that 1939 language, the first time you read it, it's hard. But there were things in there that I had identified with. And what I did a lot was I read a lot of the personal stories in the back, which I encourage my sponsees to do today. I think that it's a really great way to identify. And they're a lot easier to read. But, you know, certain things that I read while I was there really jumped out at me, and I was able to recognize these things in myself. I'm just going to read this one part on page 62 that really jumped out at me from the beginning, because I'll just read it first. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. And it's like, I never got that before, you know? I was always so mired in like this self-pity and this delusion that everything was everybody else's fault, and that it had nothing to do with me. And when I read that, it just made sense, you know? It's like, it's not all about me. You know, it's not all about other people, you know? It's not what others are doing to me. It's like, this is all coming from within me and how I perceive things, and my perception was so warped, you know? So that really jumped out at me. And, you know, there's lots of things in the book that jumped out at me, but I'm grateful that I went to treatment. I don't think that treatment in and of itself is going to solve anybody's drinking problem. I think that it's a good start, you know, it's a good way to separate yourself from drugs and alcohol, because, you know, sometimes we just can't do that when we're out here. And to be physically separated, you know, is where you've got to make your start, because you've got to get your mind clear in order to be open and ready to do the work that's required to get well. So, you know, that's the purpose of treatment. And then, you know, but that by itself, it's not enough. You have to, you know, once you get out, I've got to get into this work, you know, that's the important thing. If I don't continue on a path of recovery laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps with a sponsor, then I don't believe that I could have recovered. So I'm very grateful that I was pointed in the right direction. So I do believe that when I was there and I started to get this awareness of myself and an awareness of, you know, my part in things somewhat, and the idea that there were other people like me and all that stuff that I talked about before, I believe that that was like the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me. And I didn't see it at the time, and I struggled with it a lot. I wanted to get well, and I wanted to do what was necessary to get well. And I am such a perfectionist that I struggled with it, thinking, it's just not working. It's just not working. You know, I kept saying that. But looking back, I can see that, you know, that was the beginnings of a spiritual awakening. But by itself, you know, I had to keep on, basically. So once I got home, I started going to meetings every day. It was a really scary place to be. I got home to my house, and I was no longer in that safe cocoon where, you know, there was alcohol everywhere around me, and I was still suffering from the obsession at that point. You know, I wanted to drink really bad, and I thought, and I kept telling myself, you know, well, maybe I can, you know, maybe I can, now that I'm, you know, I've got 30 days clean, I can go out there and it'll be okay if I just have one or two. And, you know, thankfully I didn't do that, but I'm going to read one more little thing because it just reminds me of that. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. And that was the case with me. It was like, you know, here I'd come, you know, just 30 days prior, you know, I was drinking every single day, and but I couldn't, and had all, you know, these consequences of, you know, this episode that led me to rehab and like all this destruction that I'd wrought in my family, and I couldn't remember any of that. You know, it's like it was going to be okay, like I could drink now, right? But I didn't do that. I did what I'd been taught, and they had told me to go to meetings, so I did. And I started going to a meeting like every day for the first, I guess I probably went for 90 days every day because they told me to. And I was out there hunting for a sponsor, and because I knew that I had to do that too. And I was stressed about that because, you know, nobody seemed to be I wanted it to be the right person, you know, like it had to be, it couldn't just be anybody. So thankfully, about 10 days in, you know, God put the right person into my path. And I was sponsored by this wonderful woman for a year, the whole first year of my sobriety. And she took me through the steps, the way that she had been taken through the steps. We got straight into the book, and I quickly, we did 1, 2, 3, and quickly I started writing an inventory. And I'm really thankful that I was able to get through that work quickly. The book has a real clear timeline about that. You know, when you get to the fourth step in the book, you know, it says we launched onto a course of vigorous action. You know, I think that if I had waited, I think that if I had sat around and just gone to meetings, that I couldn't have held out. You know, I would have gone back to it. So I got straight into that work, and thankfully was able to, you know, my first inventory that I did, I was about 90 days sober, I think, and I didn't get everything on that inventory, but it was enough, you know, for a good start. And I stressed about that too, because again, the perfectionist in me was like, you know, I've got to get, you know, everything on there. But I couldn't remember everything. You know, my mind wasn't totally clear yet. So I did the best that I could, you know. I was fearless and thorough as I could be at 90 days. And I got a lot of stuff down. And then I talked about it with my sponsor. You know, we did a fifth step. And I got a lot of freedom through doing that fifth step. And I was able to, you know, she was able to show me the patterns of my behavior. And we were able to pull out those character defects and see them, you know. And it was the first time that I had ever looked at myself in that way and been able to see the character defects that I'd been using all my life and, you know, how destructive that had been to myself and to others. So I did that in, you know, 6 and 7, which I believe are really the crux of the program. You know, we do an inventory so that we can find the character defects. And when we find the character defects, it's time to get rid of them, you know? And sometimes it's not easy to get rid of them. But I became willing, at least on that first go around, the defects I discovered in that first go around, I was ready to get rid of those. So I became willing and gave it to God, and he took them away. And they still crop up occasionally, but, you know, I'm not perfect. I mean, as much as I'd like to think I am. So, you know, and then I got to start making amends. And I got some of my amends done that first time through, but, you know, fear kept me from doing some of them as well. But the ones that I did do, you know, that's where real freedom comes to, is in doing amends and, you know, cleaning up my side of the street. And I was able to do that. And so when I got to be about a year sober, I decided that I wanted a new experience. And I felt very pulled to move away from the sponsor that I had and start working with someone new. And I was scared to do that, you know, because the people pleaser in me was like, well, I don't want to hurt her feelings, you know. But ultimately, I had to do what was best for me, and I had to start having a new experience. And so I found a new sponsor at that point. And I was able to go through the work with him. And in fact, he's in this room right now, Jerry. And Jerry was an awesome sponsor, and I was so happy to work with him. You know, he took me through the book. We got a lot of work done. But the point in that is that I had to recognize that I was growing, and I needed to grow further. And I needed to do that with somebody new. So that's what I did. And I've continued to do that. And I've since switched sponsors again. And I'm now working with a woman who, you know, we've gone through, we did an inventory. We did a very, very complete inventory this time. And I got a lot of freedom through that, because I finally, a year sober, I'm able to remember things that I wasn't able to get down on that first one. So the point is that I don't just work the steps one time and then stop. I'm going to continue to work the steps for the rest of my life. I'm going to, you know, keep doing it. You know, I'll go back to the beginning every time. And I have to do that. And sometimes that's in the form of, you know, working with my sponsees. I work the steps with them as well. But to go back to the steps, I work a 10th step to the best of my ability, you know, every day. I try to, you know, the book says a lot of people will just, you know, think back through their day at the end of the day and do a review, an end of the day review. But for me, you know, the book's pretty clear how it says, you know, continue throughout your day. So when I screw up in the middle of the day, you know, I stop and I ask God's help and I talk to someone else about it. And there's two other things. I'm going to have to refer to the book because I'm too nervous to quote it out of my head. So we ask God to direct our thinking. No, that's not it. We ask God to remove them, and we discuss it with someone immediately, and we make amends quickly, and then we turn our thoughts to someone we can help. So, you know, it's awesome to have these instructions here that, you know, throughout my day, if I screw up, it tells me exactly what I need to do to make things right. And I'm able to, keep resentment and fear from cropping up throughout my day by, just working this step, which is awesome. Step 11, I wake up each morning and I hit my knees right as I get out of bed. Because I have to start my day that way. I have to start my day with a connection to my God. And that is such a relief to have that today. Because that is something that is, until I got into this program, I never had any kind of connection with a God of my understanding. The only God that I knew up until this point was the God that my parents taught me, you know, the God that of the church that I was forced to go to growing up. And I never had a personal relationship with that God. You know, that God was just somebody that judged me and somebody that, you know, looked at me and judged me for all the bad stuff that I was doing, you know. And the God that I have today is loving and understanding, and I'm able to, I can feel the sense of, you know, forgiveness and love and tolerance and everything that, you know, he just loves me unconditionally, and that's so wonderful. I was taught in this book, you know, that all I have to do in order to achieve that is to be willing to have that relationship with God, and I have to seek him. I'm just going to read this on page 46 about seeking God. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It's open, we believe, to all men. And that is so comforting to me, to know that, you know, he's just there and all I have to do is look for him. I'm basically I'd been turned away, you know, from the sunlight of the spirit for all those years, and now all I have to do is just turn my face back. You know, I just turn my face back to God, and he's there. You know, he never went away. I'm the one that went away. And that's just awesome. So I start my day in prayer. I believe that I also have to meditate. You know, every morning I have to sit quietly and listen for God, because I can't just do all the talking. You know, God doesn't really need to hear me talk, because he knows what's in my heart anyway, you know. It's like, it's the meditation that is so super important to me, because that's where I get a chance to listen and get answers. But step 12 is really, you know, that's where it's at, you know. That's the uncut dope. If you, when you get to the place, you know, where you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of doing these steps, you know, I've got to pass that on. And I want to pass that on, you know, and that's what I have to do in order to stay where I'm at, you know, in order to continue to grow, I've got to pass it on to the next person. And it's something that I enjoy, you know. I'm completely blessed and honored to sponsor 5 women today. And to take these women through the work the way that I was taken through the work, and to see the light go off in their eyes, is nothing short of miraculous. I absolutely love it. And, you know, I work with women as much as I can, because that's where it's at. And I just want to talk about, in closing, something that happened, that things that, you know, things haven't always been easy in sobriety. I'm so grateful that I have this program today, because when things that are difficult come up, I now have a solution. And in February of this year, I got a phone call one day. Well, actually, the way it went down is my husband came home from work, and he sat me down and he said, you know, Jackie, I have to tell you something. You know, you need to sit down. In fact, we need to pray before I even tell you. And I was like, okay, what? And he said, your little brother has committed suicide. And I can't even tell you what that was like, to have to find out that my baby brother had killed himself that day. It was absolutely devastating. But I immediately found hope, you know, in my heart. I prayed immediately, you know, just turned it over to God. And like, it's in the most difficult times like that that God shows up the most, you know. It was like, that's where I've felt the most peace in my sobriety. It was in that most difficult time in my life. And I just am so grateful for that, because I was able to, you know, do what I've been taught, which was, you know, I called my sponsor immediately. I hit my knees, and I just gave it to God. And then I was able to show up for my family. And if I hadn't had this program at that time, then there's no telling what would have happened. You know, there's no telling where I would have gone with that. But I was at complete peace, and able to be there, you know, for other people in my family who don't have a program to work like me. And I'm just really grateful that I was able to do that. And I'm super grateful for this program. When I think about where I was and how far I've come, where I am today, I just have nothing but gratitude in my heart. And I'm grateful to the people that I've met along the way. I'm grateful to this book, for the program laid out in this book. And most of all, I'm just grateful that I have a relationship with a God of my understanding. And I think I'm just going to end with that. So.